Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellefson with the Digital Education Podcast. And so it's interesting for me as I have conversations with innovators, educators, and leaders in the education space. Today, I'm with Kerry McDonald. She's an expert, an education policy writer, and an expert in unschooling, whose writing has appeared at Forbes, NPR, Newsweek, Education Next, Natural Mother Magazine, Feed.org, and Intellectual Takeout. And before we get into other things, because there's some other stuff about a new book that's coming out and some other things, you wrote for Feed.org today about compulsory education, or if there was one thing that you'd change about the education system, you'd eliminate state compulsory schooling statutes. And you said, and you conclude the article by saying, education freedom begins when government compulsion ends. So Kerry, thanks for being with me. I'm just going to throw it right there to you and say, you know, like, how does this all work and how does the unschooling fit? And then how do we kind of get to this place where we get compulsory education away so that then we can innovate and truly get into what education is?
Great. Well, I'm glad to be here, Eric. Yeah, I think there's a lot there to unpack. We can start with this Feed.org article that I wrote today about compulsory schooling. And I think it's important to make the distinction, as I do in the article, between compulsory schooling and compulsory education. So compulsory education laws have been around for quite a long time. The first compulsory education laws were passed in Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1642 and 1647, respectively. What those laws did, again, this was not too long after the Pilgrims arrived in Plymouth, Massachusetts, back then, that these early compulsory education laws really established a state interest in an educated citizenry, recognized that it was important for people to be educated in order to build a new society. And it also, these laws, these early laws, compelled cities and towns of a certain size to hire a teacher and or open and operate a grammar school. So if you had at the time a town with about 50 families, you had to hire a teacher. If you had over 100 families, you had to open and operate a grammar school. It was the towns that were compelled by law to provide schooling. But parents were not compelled to send their children to these public schools. So the compulsion was really from the state onto the cities and towns. The cities and towns were fined if they did not comply with these laws. But there was never the expectation that parents would be required to send their children to these public schools under a legal threat of force. That didn't come until a couple of hundred years later when Massachusetts again led the way, this time with the country's first compulsory schooling law. And there's a real distinction here between compulsory education and compulsory schooling. And the 1852 law mandated, under a legal threat of force, that parents must send their children to school. And so that, I think that that's a real important distinction, because education is, and this sort of gets to your other point around unschooling, education is much broader than just schooling. I think since the 19th century, since these compulsory schooling laws, we have grown to think of education and schooling as synonymous, but really that's not the case. And prior to the 19th century, we had a highly educated citizenry. Prior to the passage of compulsory schooling laws, literacy rates were upwards of 90% of the population was literate. So education was, again, broadly defined and diversely offered through an array of different mechanisms, one of which was schooling, but certainly not only schooling. You had homeschooling was, of course, the default. Many families taught their own children at home. You had dame schools, which were like kindergartens in your neighbor's kitchen, and that taught young children reading and writing. You had robust apprenticeship programs. So there was a real kind of broad definition of education, and that all becomes narrowed in the mid-19th century into the four walls of a public school classroom with the advent of these compulsory schooling laws. And what the AFP.org article today talks about what sort of prompted me to write this article today, although I do love writing about compulsory schooling, was an in-depth article recently in the HuffPost about sort of the modern ramifications of these compulsory schooling statutes, namely their impact on or their involvement with truancy laws. So truancy laws really originate from compulsory attendance laws, compulsory schooling laws. And really looking at this crackdown on families of truant children, how particularly in this case in the HuffPost article, California in particular has been cracking down on families for truancy. And unfortunately, as is often the case, it's more of the disadvantaged, disenfranchised families that bear the brunt of these kind of deeply flawed and archaic compulsory schooling laws. When often there are other reasons why children wouldn't be going to school. In the case of the HuffPost article, the woman's daughter had severe chronic illness, was in and out of the hospital and that sort of thing. But often it's rampant bullying, a feeling that the school isn't meeting the child's needs. And for many families, in fact, for most families, these families have very limited choices. They can't afford private school. They can't make homeschooling work for their family. And so their only choice is to send their child to an assigned district school, again, under a legal threat of force.
So, and it's interesting because, you know, I had a unique experience when I moved back to California 8 years ago with a student who was, in a sense, being, you know, in a lot of ways being targeted by the public schools for truancy. And so there's a story in there, but it's kind of led me to a very unique and a unique approach to even guiding students through the system, through multidimensional system and through multiple schools. But you do have a book, and in your book that's coming out here in about a month, it's called Unschooling, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom. And I'm really interested in it because in another article, you also mentioned to successfully move into the innovation era, we need a new model of education that supports a child's natural creativity, exuberance, and ingenuity. If schooling was for the past, then unschooling is for the future. And so I'm really interested and intrigued in this idea, and definitely interested in reading the book. But how do you help people like who might be afraid of unschooling or might be afraid of kind of some of this deinstitutionalization of the education system or the public schools themselves? And how do you explain unschooling that allows for like it allows for parents to choose and allows for kids to kind of find their place and to find that place where they can grow and excel and find their creativity or just even develop it further?
Right. So I think there's really two responses to that question. The first is in terms of, you know, how do you convince people around that this sort of deinstitutionalization of education works? And one of my favorite quotes, and in fact, one of my favorite authors on this topic, who you may be familiar with, is John Taylor Gatto, who sadly passed away last fall, but was a prolific author, most well known for his books, Weapons of Mass Instruction and Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling. John Taylor Gatto was a teacher in the New York public schools for 30 years. He was New York State Teacher of the Year and famously resigned from his teaching role on the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal in 1991. Saying he could no longer hurt children to make a living, really finding compulsory government schooling to be damaging to children. One of my favorite quotes by him that I think speaks to your question is when he says, when you take the free will out of education, that turns it into schooling. And I really love that quote because I think it speaks to the heart of unschooling and sort of the philosophy of unschooling, which is this idea that humans are innately designed to learn. We have we have sort of these drives for curiosity, for discovery, for exploring our world, for synthesizing information and knowledge. And we can see this very clearly in young children who are passionate learners. are able to learn an incredible amount of information without really systematic teaching when they're young. They learn their entire native language, for example, when they're just a couple of years old, without really any classroom learning. And incredible growth happens in those early years. And what, John Taylor Gatta would say, and certainly what I write about in my Unschooled book, is that these drives for learning do not just disappear magically when a child turns 4, 5, or 6 and heads into school. We turn off these drives in children, these natural self-educative drives, with a coercive system of institutional schooling. And so I think what those of us who really advocate for self-directed education and unschooling would say is that we just need to stop doing that. That we just have to stop shifting this education, this natural sort of learning and education process from a bottom-up organic process that all young people are endowed with, and when we then move into the sort of top-down coercive model of teaching that happens in institutional schooling. So I think that's sort of the first part of your question. I think the other piece, you have a quote of mine that you mentioned, which talks about, unschooling is for the future. And I think it's becoming increasingly apparent as humans compete with robots, as robots begin to take on a lot of the previous competitive advantages that humans had, that what still currently distinguishes us from robots, and those are characteristics like creativity and imagination and ingenuity and an entrepreneurial spirit. These are things that robots haven't quite caught up to us yet. They may, but they haven't. And so if we really want to facilitate these deeply human characteristics, these deeply human competitive advantages, the best way of doing that is to prevent young people from going into kind of this coercive system of institutional schooling where they have their creativity systematically snuffed out in the name of conformity and standardization. And so what we unschooling advocates would say is we don't need to kind of teach people how to be creative or imaginative or entrepreneurial. We just need to stop destroying those natural tendencies that the humans already have through our system of forced schooling.
So you're not only just an education policy advocate and writer, you're also a parent. And you talk about being a parent and living this out. I'm interested, how did you come to this place where it's like, I just want to do something different and do it different with and for my kids? Because a lot of times what we do, we get in education policy, is we get a lot of advocates who then don't do it with their own, their own kids or their own lives or their own families. Like when people come to you and say, how do you do this with, or how have you seen other parents or other families make the decision too of saying, you know what, I just want to look at doing this different so that I can foster that ingenuity, that creativity, that human spirit in my own kids.
Yeah, so I kind of came to education policy and alternatives to school back when I was in college. I was an economics undergraduate, but I had a minor in education. And my senior year of college, I had an opportunity to do an independent research project on some topic in alternative education, and I heard about homeschooling, which I had never heard about before, never knew a homeschooler. I went through K-12 public schools, and I had a chance to shadow a local homeschooling family, and I was completely enchanted by what I saw of just this deep, authentic learning, genuine immersion into the people, places, and things of the community that was strikingly different from sort of the age-segregated, standardized classrooms that I was also at that same time witnessing in a student teaching practicum in a local public elementary school. So those images, those contrasting images, really stuck with me and prompted me to go to graduate school in education policy at Harvard, where I became more interested in these topics, more interested in alternative education, but specifically alternatives to school. And then it really wasn't until I became a mom about a decade later, looking at education options for my own children, that I revisited homeschooling and discovered self-directed education and realized that this was going to be the right fit for our family, that decided that I didn't want to be replicating school at home as we would commonly think of conventional homeschooling being like, but I really wanted to embrace these ideas of interest-based learning for my children. I was noticing that they were doing so many, learning so many things on their own with adult support, certainly with immersion in their larger community, but really based on their interests and their distinct interests and passions, that was really what was driving their learning. And so we just continued kind of along that path. And that's what I would say, as you mentioned about what other families and other parents can do. I think it's really just listening to your children, trusting your children, watching what they're interested in. And then the key piece for unschooling families or educators is connecting those emerging interests with available resources, whether those are real resources, actual resources in your community, or increasingly digital resources that I think are what makes self-directed education so much more accessible, so much more of a possibility for more families than ever before.
So let me ask this question then, because I'm a traditional educator in a fairly traditional system, and I love my profession, I love my job, but I think for me, it's always been this odd thing of trying to do it different, looking for different ways to do it different, trying to, you know, build unique ways to, you know, just kind of look at it. What would be the encouragement, or what do you see when you work, you know, kind of in this, you know, self-directed, you know, learning movement, unschooling movement? What would be the encouragements or suggestions that you give an educator like me or a lot of my friends who are saying, you know, yes, this appeals to us. Yes, we'd like to do it different, but yet we're still in a fairly stuck, you know, traditional system.
Right. I would say two things. First, what became really fascinating for me as I was writing Unschooled, which really profiles families, educators, and entrepreneurs who are building and growing self-directed learning opportunities throughout the country and indeed the world, what became really apparent really quickly was how many of these educators that were launching self-directed learning centers, or what I call unschooling schools, were traditional public school teachers who became disillusioned by what they were seeing, particularly in a test-driven, standardized schooling environment, and were looking for other options, other alternatives. Was there anything else where they could channel this passion for education, passion for helping young people to, you know, achieve their maximum potential without the sort of coercion and compulsion that exists in conventional mass schooling? And what I heard over and over in these instances where these educators then left these public school classrooms to launch their own initiatives was that it was just random. They randomly happened upon a book, for example, by John Taylor Gatto, who I mentioned earlier, or by another author in this space. Or my favorite story is one of the educators who launched a learning center outside of Boston, Massachusetts, where I am located. He was a conventional high school teacher, really disillusioned by what he was seeing in the classroom, wanted to do something different, but didn't know where to begin, didn't even know if there were other options. And he happened to be driving along the highway one afternoon and saw on the a road sign on the highway for a place called North Star Self-Directed Learning for Teens out in Western Massachusetts, which happens to be one of the first self-directed learning centers that opened in the mid-1990s by another former public school teacher. Well, this particular educator swerves off the highway, didn't know anything about this center, and then found, you know, made connections, connected with the founder of North Star, and then ultimately launched his own learning center closer to Boston that follows that North Star model. And these are these kinds of random stories that appear throughout the book. And so one of the things I keep thinking is, how do we make these less random? is that clearly there are a lot of educators who are dissatisfied with not only their jobs as conventional educators, but with conventional schooling in general, who are looking for alternatives. How do we make that process less random for them to find these other options? So that's one piece that I think is really interesting. The second piece that I would say, and this is closer to where you are out in California, there is one public school in the country right now that is incorporating self-directed learning principles in what I would call an unschooling way. It is called Unschool San Juan. It's located in the San Juan Unified School District just outside of Sacramento, California. A fully public, non-charter district high school. And I'd encourage your listeners to go ahead and Google Unschool San Juan and watch their trailer video. And you'll see that a lot of the principles of self-directed learning are being incorporated into that particular school. And that could be another, you know, possibility for educators who are interested in these ideas and maybe want some inspiration to see if they could do something like this in their home district.
So let me ask just one final question, because this is awesome, and especially these resources to get people connected, because I've found so often in education, the inspiration comes from, you know, that visit or that place or somebody who's just, you know, that one step ahead. And, you know, so as you think about this, from a larger perspective, like what, you know, and it's, I think there's a lot of hope for what I see out there with some of this and doing it different. Are there bits and pieces of just excitement that you have for what's out there? And maybe one or two specific things that you see that get you excited for what the future of schooling could actually be?
Yes, I am very excited by the future of education innovation more broadly, by education choice and parental empowerment. I think that's where the real change is going to come. I think parents are fed up with a one-size-fits-all model of learning and are looking for choices. My larger goal or commitment is to expanding education choice, to put parents back in the driver's seat, to give them lots of options for their children. And then, of course, I would love for more parents to embrace, and educators to embrace, these ideals of self-directed learning and unschooling. But that's just one of a sort of a large menu of education possibilities. And my main goal is to empower parents to find the education resources and opportunities that are best fit for their families and for their children, and expand those opportunities so that we aren't sort of stuck with this default and mandatory system of compulsory mass schooling.
Carrie, I'm really thankful for your time today. And besides the book, and I'll put a link to the podcast and connect it, I'm excited to read it myself. What are there other places where people can go to get information on some of your work or some of the organizations that you're part of?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at Kerry, KERRY_EDU. I'm also on Facebook and Instagram at Whole Family Learning, and my website is wholefamilylearning.com. And the article we began the podcast talking about is at fee.org, the Foundation for Economic Education, where I'm a frequent contributor.
Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric.